From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana.
It did not ever work. I was involved in Love in Action for 22 years full-time, worked with hundreds of people, and I did not see a single person who ever found freedom from same-sex attractions or freedom from their homosexuality.
Striking while public attention is elevated for the ongoing Pray Away the Gay quackery that targets vulnerable LGBTQI plus persons, almost always under the pretext of religion, a coalition of credible voices is coming together for a Christian case against conversion therapy. That's the name of a free webinar coming on Tuesday, August 24th. And we'll get details from one of the leaders taking part, Amber Cantorna.
The pullout of U.S. troops is part of an agreement made by Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, with the Taliban in 2020.
We've all heard the terrible news out of Afghanistan in recent days, and there's been no shortage of tactical and ethical analysis of what got us to this moment. But a unique and deeply personal perspective comes from the group 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, who have invested two decades into remembering their loved ones lost on that September Tuesday by demanding nonviolent solutions in the Middle East and beyond. On this week's show, we'll get the insights of Afghanistan committee facilitator Ellen Judd.
The Delta variant was nonsense then. It is nonsense now. You will not wear masks in this church. You will not wear masks in this church. I'm telling you right now, do not get vaccinated. Do not get vaccinated. So all this fear bull crap is that. It is bull crap. Say amen.
There is no shortage of incivil outrages being perpetrated under the guise of religion, and the special protections granted to religious speech and organizing under our Constitution. There is no shortage of reporting on those outrages either. But perhaps unique in mustering Americans of goodwill to act in response and opposition to such outrages is the organization Faithful America. And today, we'll get another one of our regular updates from Executive Director, the Reverend Nathan Imsall.
I'm Ray Kirstein at the intersection of religion, government, and sharp objects. Religion News Service reports that Catholic Cardinal Raymond Burke of Wisconsin allowed conservative voice raised, among other things, to undermine the confidence of the faithful in COVID-19 vaccines, has been himself diagnosed with the virus and is reportedly on a ventilator. Burke is 73. Conservatives in the American Roman Catholic hierarchy, who are far from representative of the majority of Catholics in this country, is working hard to develop legalistic exemptions from anticipated vaccination mandates on religious grounds. Pope Francis has a different message on this. He recently wrote, quote, "Being vaccinated with vaccines authorized by the competent authorities is an act of love, and contributing to ensure the majority of people are vaccinated is an act of love." Texas Governor Greg Abbott, he of the ranks of Republican governors who have moved from merely sneering at mask mandates to actively undermining local safety regulations with arbitrary dictates and focusing on defending the rights of unvaccinated Texans and defiant claims of immunity from any rules by religious groups, has now joined the ranks of Americans who have tested positive for COVID-19.
Our program airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. State of Belief Radio is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you. Thank you so much. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And now, to our first guest.
The last time Welton spoke with Amber Cantorna on this program, her powerful book, Unashamed, was just coming out. It was a memorable interview. It's available at stateofbelief.com. And we've been meaning to invite her back to the show for quite a while now. That's why when we saw that the upcoming The Christian Case Against Conversion Therapy webinar featured Amber's name prominently in the description, we quickly made the call. She said yes, and so, Amber Cantorna, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me back.
The webinar is coming up on Tuesday, August 24th, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Central. What's on the agenda?
Well, the goal is to really talk about conversion therapy and specifically to address the new documentary that recently released on Netflix, Pray Away, which really addresses the harms of conversion therapy, both nationwide and around the world.
A lot of people are actually surprised every time we talk about it that this practice even happens anymore. Thankfully, it's things like that film, Pray Away, that has helped raise awareness this time around. But what's the specific goal of this webinar?
Well, I think what we are seeing a lot of is that, the more conservative leaning people tend to not realize the harm that conversion therapy does to LGBT people of faith. And the people that lean more liberal often don't realize that this practice is even going on. And so the goal of both Pray Away and of the webinar next week is to really raise awareness of what is going on in our country in the name of faith, in the name of God, that is actually taking the lives of LGBTQ people.
We regularly feature voices from Good Faith Media and Baptist News Global on the show. We've also introduced our listeners to the Q Christian Fellowship in the past. How did this collaboration come about and how did you get involved?
Well, I think the collaboration began with Baptist News Global's Mark Wingfield, and I write a monthly column for them. And so he reached out to me to represent Baptist News in the webinar. But really, it's a collaboration of, like you said, Good Faith Media, Q Christian Fellowship. I believe Darren Calhoun will also be on the webinar representing the board of Q Christian. And it's really just a way to bring these people together to dialogue, to start conversations, to raise awareness, and to share stories of people's own experience of ex-gay and conversion therapy.
Amber, would you talk about your own experiences with the quackery of so-called conversion therapy? Who in your life has been affected?
Well, I myself have been affected, and I'll tell you why, because I really believe that conversion therapy is not just a program. You don't have to enroll in an ex-gay conversion therapy program like Exodus to be really affected by the harms of conversion therapy. Conversion therapy is this idea. It's a system of belief that teaches Christians, that teaches LGBTQ people that being gay, that being trans, that being bisexual is not okay. It is inherently wrong in the eyes of God, and that there is something that needs to be changed, healed, or fixed about you. And so it's not just these programs that are trying to change and fix people. It is this system of belief that is permeating our churches. It's permeating the pulpits. It's permeating our family dialogue and discussions and our dinner tables about really our intrinsic worth and who is valued and who is not valued and who is welcome and not welcome at the table of God. And so these conversations are important to raise awareness of the harms that are being done, because really these programs and these systems of belief are teaching LGBT people that they are not okay, that they are inherently wrong, sinful, need to be fixed or changed. And that then creates this psychological warfare inside them to try and separate who they are, their sexual orientation or their gender identity, from their faith and their relationship with Christ. And so our goal is to really reframe that narrative and let people know that they can be both LGBTQ plus and or a person of faith.
I haven't seen the film, to be honest, but does that include stories? And are you referencing experiences of the same kind of false science actually being applied to women as well?
Absolutely, yes. In fact, the documentary features two females that were also held up as poster child, especially Julie Rogers, but also Yvette Cantu-Schneider, who I just hosted an interview with this last week. Both of them are featured prominently in the documentary and share their stories of conversion therapy as well.
Before we started on the air, we were talking about a small world of activism, but it's also a small world in an interesting way of people featured in this film. I hadn't realized Julie Rogers was also in the film. She's got an amazing new book out.
She does.
She's going to be on the show next week.
Oh, wonderful.
Talking about that. Outloved, right?
Outlove, yes.
Outlove. Is there an aspect of this ex-gay abuse that is being applied to transgender people in new and cruel ways? Because this really is the population in the crosshairs of political religious right propaganda right now. Are they also using this weapon against trans lives and identities?
They are now. I don't know that that has always been the case. You know, if you watch the documentary, it's interesting because they feature primarily people who identified as gay and lesbian in the film. And I think historically, that's what conversion therapy has been known for, is trying to fix people from gay to straight. You know, but at the time that conversion therapy rose to the surface, transgender identities weren't being talked about very much at that time. So that really wasn't featured much in their programs or in the documentary. However, because, you know, with marriage equality and some of those things coming to the surface, I feel like as we move towards better equality for gay and lesbian people, we now are seeing a rise and a push against people who identify as transgender. The only person that they featured in the documentary that was currently engaged in conversion therapy was a person that said they were a transgender previously and now were no longer so. And so it's, you know, of course, the documentary is hard to watch and quite triggering for people who identify as LGBTQ. But I think it's such an important conversation to realize that this is not just something of the past, that this is still very much alive and well now, and that people like Jeffrey McCall, who is the individual I was just mentioning in the film, are still claiming that they were previously transgender, they are no longer, and that Jesus has saved them from this.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned dominance as sort of the operative process, if not even the objective of this kind of dehumanizing quote unquote therapy. And it does strike me that it puts straight males in a position of determining the acceptability of the very humanity or identity of other people. And that, to me, can't be separated from the crisis that's currently racking so many churches regarding the role and the abuse of women.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and you do see that in the documentary, the majority of this is driven by white straight males, that they are creating the status quo, so to speak. And we are seeing that, you know, patriarchy, white supremacy, those kind of things still being very much at the forefront of these discussions and the need for more diversity, more inclusion everywhere to help break down those systems. I think one of the most fascinating things is the research Kathy Baldock is currently doing with her new book that will release, I believe, in November, called Forging a Sacred Weapon, How the Bible Became Anti-Gay. And really the research that she's uncovered around the white straight males who were the ones to initially put the word homosexuality into the Bible, and virtually how it was a mistake. And she's got the research to prove it. She's found the people who were involved. And it really, I think, has the power to change history, the course of history for LGBT people moving forward.
Can't wait for that. Thank you. What else do you think most people still don't know, if there is anything, about the effect of this misguided practice of conversion therapy?
Well, I think going back to what I mentioned earlier is that people often believe that conversion therapy is only for those who enroll in a program. They go to either a therapist or a group, a support group, where they are trying to be fixed or healed. But really, it's not just that. I mean, I myself never actually enrolled in a conversion therapy program. However, my story is the perfect example of the harms of conversion therapy. You know, my father was in a very high position at Focus on the Family for over 30 years, and their belief that being gay was inherently wrong is what tore our family apart. And my family completely disowned me when I came out. I haven't had contact with them in almost a decade. And so I feel like internalized homophobia is alive and well, regardless of whether you engage in a program or not. And I think people need to be aware of that and be aware of the harms of the conversion therapy programs themselves, and the fact that almost 30 states still allow conversion therapy for minors. It is not illegal. It's only illegal in 20 states currently, and there's a few pending, but there are still many states where conversion therapy is legal for minors and they have no control over it, which really, if it boils down to the fact that they are being brainwashed and programmed to hate themselves and to hate who they are. And it creates psychological damage, which leads to substance abuse and self-harm and suicide. And so what we're dealing with is quite serious and is taking the lives of many people.
The tragedy is multiplied for a lot of people because a wedge can get driven between their authentic LGBTQI plus identities and their faith, their religion itself.
Absolutely.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's like you're facing an ultimatum to choose between your sexual orientation and your love or your love for God or your faith. And people believe that absolutely is the case, and it just does not have to be. I mean, that was certainly the upbringing that I was taught, which really ripped me apart. I dealt with a great deal of internalized homophobia. I engaged in a lot of self-harm, and I was suicidal because I felt that this disqualified me from being in the family of God, and that because I was gay, I was completely unusable, that God would never be able to use me. Nobody was ever going to want me. I was inherently trash. And that's what I believed about myself. And that is the message that people are receiving about who they are because of something that they have no control over. And I think we need to normalize LGBTQ plus identities and realize that sexual orientation and gender identity are all part of a spectrum of who we are, and that there is no hierarchy. One is not better or greater than the other. They're all beautiful and acceptable ways of living and being, and that needs to be celebrated and normalized so that people are not being pitted against themselves, at war within themselves about their identity and something that they cannot change.
So who's the webinar on Tuesday for, and how can listeners sign up for it?
Well, it's free, so we can certainly give you a link to sign up for it. Everyone is welcome to attend. And it's really for anyone who is interested in dialoguing about conversion therapy, learning more about conversion therapy, learning more about the harms of conversion therapy, and really what the Christian approach is to this moving forward, and how we can kind of change that dialogue and kind of this nuanced conversation moving forward to create better, healthier lives for LGBTQ people, especially those from a faith background. So anyone that's open to having that conversation, to learning more about the appropriate Christian response to conversion therapy is certainly welcome to attend.
We will post the link at stateofbelief.com. And I think it's a powerful title, The Christian Case Against Conversion Therapy. Again, Tuesday, 12 noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Amber, what have you been focusing on in your work in activism, and how can our listeners follow your writing and your leadership going forward?
Well, one of the projects that I've launched over the last year is the Unashamed Love Collective. And this has become an online private community of LGBTQ people, allies, parents of LGBTQ kids, and affirming faith leaders. And we gather in a private space online, and we read books by LGBTQ authors and allies. We read a different book every month, and then we have dialogues in our group throughout the month. And at the end of the month, we do an online gathering where we host the author of our book and dialogue with them directly. And so it's become a really beautiful space of people that are kind of in all walks of their life, all different spaces of deconstruction, coming out. Everybody's kind of in a different place, and yet we all share such a similar journey and experience. And so it's been a great way to connect and really build lasting relationships in a safe community. And so that's been one of my favorite projects that I've been a part of. And we only open registration twice a year because we like to really keep it tight-knit and close and safe for everyone, make sure that it's a safe space for everyone to be seen and heard. But we actually have registration open through the end of August right now. And our new season will launch September 1st. So people that are wanting to engage, people that are wanting to be a part of a community where they just they're safe, you know, nobody can see who's in there. So they're safe to be out. They're safe to ask hard questions. They're safe to deconstruct. And this next season, we'll be hosting Jennifer Knapp. We'll be hosting Brian McLaren and Kathy Baldock's new book. So we've got a really great lineup of authors and books that we'll be reading. But it's also just a great place to engage in community and build lasting relationships. So if people that are wanting more information about that can go to my website, ambercantorna.com, and click the book club link, and all the information that they need there to register will be available.
Amber Cantorna is a national speaker, thought leader, and author who specializes in bringing messages of diversity, hope, and self-acceptance to those who have been pushed to the margins of faith and sexuality. She is the host of the Unashamed Love Collective, a safe haven for LGBTQ plus people and allies to read, learn, interact with the authors of their books, and gain support. Follow her on social media at Amber N. Cantorna and learn more about her work at ambercantorna.com. The Christian Case Against Conversion Therapy webinar is coming up on Tuesday, August 24th, and we'll link to the registration page from stateofbelief.com. Amber, thank you so much for being back with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, Ellen Judd, Afghanistan coordinator at 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, and later, the Reverend Nathan Imsall. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Few among us have not been caught up in watching the terrifying turn of events in Afghanistan in these recent days. I can't even imagine how much more painful the impact must be on those who have spent two decades dissenting from America's war-making in the Middle East, bringing the full force of their unique personal moral clarity to bear. I'm talking about the amazing Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, whose members lost loved ones in the attacks of September 11. Theirs is the perspective I most want to amplify today. And I am grateful to be joined by Ellen Judd, who works with the Afghanistan Committee. Ellen, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity and for your very warm welcome.
Would you start with just a very brief introduction to what Peaceful Tomorrows is and how the organization got started?
The organization started with a number of people speaking out immediately after 9/11 in concern about the calls for war that were being made in our name. Kathy Kelly, who's an extraordinary peace activist, helped bring these people together. A small group of four people went to Afghanistan and created a record of their encounters with people suffering the civilian casualties there. And I think that many of us felt when we were looking at the pictures of the war there that it was just like looking at 9/11. Mm. So, you know, bringing those connections out. And on that basis, Peaceful Tomorrows established itself and people discovered it and came to join. And all the members are people who did lose family members. So that, you know, to keep our message clear. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of other people involved in supporting and we have many partners as well.
What has been the position of most members of Peaceful Tomorrows toward American efforts in the Middle East?
Our focus, I think, has been primarily upon the actions that are taken in response to 9/11. Those are what our public positions are, so, involving Afghanistan and Iraq. I think that the primary views are very largely to dismay virtually all of the military intervention. I personally would oppose all of it in the Middle East. Because when we look at the disaster there, we can see that many of the problems affecting Afghanistan and Iraq are also true of Libya and Syria, for example. So that I think there's a broad sense of nonviolence on the part of the membership. But a very strong aversion to military responses to human problems.
Had the withdrawal of U.S. forces gone well, it would have been a wonderful way to mark the 20th anniversary. But that's not what happened. You and others in the organization have been in constant contact with partners in Afghanistan. So my first question is, was there ever a way that a withdrawal could have led to positive outcomes?
Looking back on all of this, I think one has to be even more foresighted and simply avoid the military intervention to begin. Because the only really good thing about war that one can do about war is to prevent it. So I think that once you're in it, extracting is enormously difficult. And it carries with it enormous obligations to try to repair the damage that has been done. So I think one could expect that having done this, that there isn't going to be an easy way to get out. So I think a lot of discussion about that, I understand that we're having it. I think that the big question really is to do everything we can to support people who are at risk now, whether to help them get out or to understand that not everybody can get out. And we need to find ways to support the people who are still going to be living under whatever it comes to follow, through international NGOs, through people-to-people contacts and transfers of resources and assistance, whatever we can do to help people wherever they are in the wake of this terrible situation. But then we need to also think about the bigger question about not to continue to do this in other places as well.
There are a lot of people who are saying, is there anything that we can do now with the U.S. government to make things any less horrific for the people of Afghanistan? How do you answer that question?
We're immediately calling for an expansion of support for evacuation. We'll have a statement on our website, and we're keeping in touch with people and looking for additional, more concrete things to do. So one of the important things that we can do, and everybody can contact their political representatives and the public, asking to expand support for evacuation, asking for negotiated and supported protection for land routes for people who aren't going to be able to get on a plane, but to get by land to an exit point and then to support them in refugee camps and on roads there to safe havens, to send financial support to people there and to look for avenues through which we can do it. Right now, banks are largely closed in Afghanistan, so trying to send funds really immediately is a challenge, but we're working on we think that will get resolved within a matter of days. We're looking at, we're suggesting, and I think it's by far the best route, to send support to international NGOs, because that de-links it and makes it more possible than if we're trying to do it through the channels that we used before. And there are organizations like the International Committee of the Red Cross, or Doctors Without Borders, or Save the Children, that have a footprint in Afghanistan and could be helpful. And we'll look at trying to get word out about more of those that people can use. And we think that it's important to keep the door open to talking with whatever authorities are present there in order to be able to influence and reach civilians at risk in Afghanistan. I don't think we should just sort of say, don't have any diplomatic relations. I think that would be disastrous. Diplomacy is an alternative to conflict. And so we need to be talking in order to do things like arrange evacuation, arrange safe passage out of the country, and get help to civilians at risk.
Ellen, what would be the most important thing that your organization is working on?
I think trying to think of everything we can do to support civilians in Afghanistan, yeah. I think, is the top priority for all of us right now. Yeah. It's also the case that there are other kinds of avenues that we have that we're working on, closing Guantanamo. We've been spending much of the entire year organizing a webinar series and a film festival for the period in September so that people can draw lessons from 9/11 and we can find nonviolent and caring ways to respond to things that aren't right in the world in a very different way. So I think it's important to respond to the immediate situation that we have before us that's so urgent, and then also to think about how to avoid those things in the future.
Mm-hmm. What do all Americans need to know now about what's been done in our name and how they can respond?
I think one can try to think about what's happened in Afghanistan as almost a continuing series of 9/11s, so that the very large number of civilians that have been affected is just absolutely overwhelming. Whatever people we manage to get out in the coming days is going to be a very small proportion of the people who are affected. So that it's going to be important for us to continue these ties. And we can do that through connections we've built up through these years. There's also now, and for decades before as well, there's a sizable Afghan diaspora. So we can connect with Afghans within our own communities who will help us make those connections and establish routes for continuing assistance. But there have been friendship and ties built up with people trying to find some respite from this war and to find some other routes forward. And we need to proceed fairly cautiously, not to put anybody at risk. But there are people where we have shared nonviolent convictions who are going to be key to building a better world as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. If you're saying to our listeners what you think and they ask, what can we do right now, what would be your answer?
My answer is first of all, to work on the issue about evacuation and refugee support. And they can do that in all kinds of different ways. There are many calls out. You can support what we're doing. A lasting resource that I hope people may be able to use is we have a website that is a very good portal to all kinds of different channels. PeacefulTomorrows.org. The website itself gives you links to our statement, and as we're able to find additional channels, we'll be posting this right on the website. And it also, in the upper right-hand corner, will take you to Facebook and Twitter if what you prefer to do is social media. So we do have a portal that is going to be available beyond what I am able to say today, because it's such a fastly moving situation. So we will be posting routes for other things to do, because it is a long-term problem. So I think that what we need to do is to reach out to people, and especially to people still within Afghanistan, because their situation is going to be vastly more difficult than that of the people that we were able to get out. But certainly we'll be having many, I hope, a very large number of people from Afghanistan that we can welcome close to our homes, and they're going to need our support.
What else are Peaceful Tomorrow's members working on ahead of the 20th anniversary? I know you mentioned the Guantanamo work that has been done. What is going to be right at the center of what you want this 20th anniversary to be about?
I think it is a reminder and a set of resources about how to find nonviolent paths forward in the world. because there isn't one single solution to this. So we'll be looking at Afghanistan and Guantanamo and responses to violence and trauma and how to build connections. We're working on peace education. If you go to our website, you'll find the Peace and Justice Film Festival that's going to be available at People's Convenience online for several days around 9/11. Is also going to include opportunities to engage with members of Peaceful Tomorrows as well and to get involved in and support our work, because it goes across the whole spectrum of nonviolence. It isn't just a response to one thing, but there's this moment allows us to reach out because so many people feel so closely touched by it.
Alan Judd is Afghanistan coordinator at 9/11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Alan, I really thank you for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
I'm very grateful for this chance to talk with you and through you with so many people in the faith communities. Thank you.
If you're not receiving the regular action alerts from the nonprofit Faithful America, you're really missing out. While sources of discouraging news are plentiful, what sets these alerts apart is the suggestion of concrete actions to take in defense of religion, our Constitution, and our neighbors. Back again with an update is the Reverend Nathan Imsall, Executive Director of Faithful America. Nathan, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Your recent mailing about a pastor who is known for kicking concerned congregants out of his church services if they show up wearing masks is particularly provocative. Who is this guy?
This guy is named Greg Locke. He is an evangelical, and that's Locke with an E at the end, and he's an evangelical pastor just outside of Nashville who has spent the entire pandemic downplaying the pandemic and now not only telling parishioners they are not allowed to wear masks at his church, but also standing there in the pulpit saying, do not get vaccinated, do not get vaccinated. Like a lot of evangelical and also Catholic fringe pastors, not the mainstream in the Catholic Church, or even I think in evangelicalism, but a lot of these fringe folks are spreading the lie that the vaccines are linked to abortion or contain stem cells, and that lie is getting people killed. And then there are all the different weird misinformation pieces that go into masks too. But in addition to all that, Locke is also preaching QAnon conspiracy theories from his pulpit and making all sorts of weird partisan claims about pedophilia and politicizing the pandemic itself, calling masks Democrat gains. I wish that we could just ignore him. I wish we could say it's one guy affecting a small amount of people, but he's making major headlines in the Washington Post and in Newsweek every single week, and that is spreading his misinformation and his lies, and that's really hurting people in Jesus' name. And he's not the only one. He's symptomatic of a much larger strain of misinformation in the church. And I think most of Faithful American members believe that we have a duty, a moral responsibility, not only to get vaccinated, but also to stand up to misinformation within the church.
What is Faithful America calling on people to do in this case? Is it about religion? Is it about politics? Or is it about somebody that's crazy?
You know, I don't want to call anybody crazy. I don't want to question motives. I think it's about public health. It's about loving your neighbor. Well, what is politics other than, as a professor of mine used to say, the art of how we live together, the art of figuring out how to live together? So, you know, whatever label you want to put on it, at the end of the day, it's the question of how do we love one another? And I think we love one another by getting vaccinated, by encouraging one another to get vaccinated, by wearing masks indoors, and by fighting sources of misinformation and trying to get the facts out there, but also trying to turn the volume down on the misinformation that does exist. It's not enough to put facts alongside the lies, you also have to turn down the volume on the lies, especially when they are spread in Jesus' name and give folks the wrong impression of not just the church, but of Jesus himself.
Mm-hmm.
So in Greg Locke's case, whenever you see a case like this, you have to ask, what's the strategic way? How can we make a difference? It doesn't really make a difference to tell the person to stop. They're not going to.
Mm-hmm.
So what we've done is look at the different platforms Locke has and say, which might listen to reason, and maybe which don't know the message he's spreading, which platforms can we help disassociate themselves from Locke, mm-hmm. and from others in Tennessee, like Pastor Gary Umbel, with the same message.
Mm-hmm.
And what Faith America is doing right now, we have partnered with local clergy in Tennessee through the Southern Christian Coalition, and we are asking venues that are sponsoring a speaking tour that includes Greg Locke to terminate the contracts they have with the tour and its events. That includes a wedding venue outside of Chattanooga called Howe Farms. We're talking to Apex Bank, and we've got almost 12,000 signatures, over 11,000 signatures on a petition, mostly Christian signatures, asking these venues to terminate these events. We're calling the venues, a few dozen calls to saying, hey, your potential customers are really worried about this. Sometimes they say, don't you care about freedom of speech? And we say, yes, please use your freedom of speech not to host these events. Please use your freedom to disassociate yourself from this deadly misinformation. We want the freedom to live in a COVID-safe environment. We want the freedom to love our neighbors. And Pastor Locke, and he's associated with this group called Tennessee Stands.
Mm.
They're the one behind most of the speaking events. Most of the events are called the Freedom Matters Tour. Alan Keyes and other notorious figures, especially locally, pastors and politicians and activists alike, are joining Greg Locke at these speaking engagements. He's not on all of them, to be fair, but all of them are twisting the Bible and the Constitution to hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're asking these venues to pull the plug on these events.
Your work is overtly nonpartisan. What's the call to action around Afghanistan that you're currently promoting?
Right. This came out a few days ago. Whatever you think of the war in Afghanistan, the 20 years of war there, and the U.S. withdrawal and how that's going, there's clearly a humanitarian crisis. And so we are asking President Biden, first of all, yes, to help everyone who helped the United States. I mean, it is an absolute travesty how many translators and interpreters and other folks who helped us are being left to face the Taliban's wrath and not getting the visas they were promised, in some cases, 10 years ago or more. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there are so many people who helped human rights nonprofits and international organizations and women and LGBTQ folks and other various religious and ethnic minorities who are going to suffer at the Taliban's hand. So we are echoing the call, various calls of other organizations, both refugee resettlement agencies and Afghan diaspora organizations, asking President Biden to welcome all vulnerable Afghans in need to this country. And there are any number of avenues the White House can take to do this, including holding the Kabul airport open, chartering as many planes as they can, both civilian and military, to get people out, raising the refugee ceiling here in the United States, all sorts of technical visa processes they can expedite and put in place.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, before you can get into the technical details, but the bottom line is there's a moral responsibility to help people in need,
mm-hmm.
especially when they are in need because of a situation we helped destabilize.
Yeah. What are some of the other issues that you're encouraging people to engage in right now?
One is that we are calling on President Biden and Congress to help vaccinate the world. We're working with Public Citizen to echo this call from Partners in Health and Oxfam and so many public health deans and professors. $34 billion from Congress, a drop in the bucket compared to every COVID bill that has passed so far, would be enough to both produce and distribute 8 billion mRNA COVID vaccines. Right now, not even 4% of people in Africa have been vaccinated. And they're not refusing the vaccine like many evangelicals and Americans. They don't have access on the continent. The shots just don't exist there.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to send surplus shots from the U.S. What the need is money and building production and distribution infrastructure. And like I say, $34 billion to help the poor, to help the marginalized, and also to prevent the creation of future strains like Delta that would then come to the United States. Mm-hmm. We're also looking at the surgeon-turned-nun, Sister Dee Dee Byrne, who became infamous when she spoke at the RNC for Donald Trump. She's now spreading COVID misinformation. We're asking Villanova and St. Thomas Catholic Universities to rescind her honorary degrees, because that would help take away some of her platform. It would give her fewer credentials to abuse and pretend that there's a veneer of authenticity to her lies about the COVID vaccines. Similar misinformation to Pastor Locke. Mm-hmm. And one other thing I'll mention on the non-COVID front, I have a toddler, and she is adorable, and almost as adorable as she is this Fisher-Price nativity set she's got. But the problem, it was given to us by a relative, but the problem is the Jesus and Holy Family figures are all white. Mm. And we know that Jesus wasn't white. Mm. As Professor Anthea Butler says, every time you see white Jesus, it spreads white supremacy. Mm. Because we keep showing folks this image of a white Jesus who's part of the racial majority in this country. Jesus was born, Jesus, God, broke into human history on the side of the oppressed. Race may not have really mattered in terms of oppression 2,000 years ago, but it does today. And so in a Western country, when we remove Jesus from communities of color that way, we remove him from the narrative of being born in occupied territory to a working class family in a barn. Fighting with the oppressed against empire. Today, Jesus would be a person of color just as he was 2,000 years ago. So we are asking Fisher-Price and Mattel to change their nativity set. Hopefully, there's still time to do that before this Christmas. If not, next Christmas. I understand production takes time. We have 12,000 signatures so far on that. I think Mattel wants to do the right thing. They were receptive to a letter we sent them before the petition. I know they've done the right thing with the Barbie line, so we hope they'll do the right thing here. And if not, petitions are never only the first step in a campaign.
Now, then, what's a couple of recent campaigns that you've used to bring people of goodwill together for important objectives? What achievements are you most proud of?
There were two last year that really stood out to me. One was working with a number of other coalition groups, Church World Service and many others, to help free a wrongly detained asylum seeker from ICE custody. He lived in a house on church grounds in Bethesda, Maryland, and ICE agents lied to lure him outside at 6 in the morning and put him in custody over one or two pieces of missed paperwork that a now disbarred lawyer had forgotten to tell him about. And working in coalition, Faithful America gathered the majority of signatures that were delivered in person to ICE headquarters in D.C. in a big march that many Faithful America members attended. Then we flooded ICE with emails, and we worked closely with the asylum seeker's pastor. We got in touch with him the day after he was detained, and he was eventually freed. And, you know, that was... We think it was partly legal action, but also partly ICE not wanting to deal with the pressure. And so he's reunited with his family, and that felt really good to see this family reunited. Yeah. I was also really excited last fall when, again, working in coalition with Muslim advocates, the NAACP, and many others, we helped stop one of Donald Trump's nominees in the Senate, a very anti-Islamic and quite frankly, just racist, anti-black figure from a major Pentagon nomination. And we got Senate Republicans who were then in the majority to cancel his nomination hearing, not even consider him, and Trump was forced to withdraw the nomination. Mm. And that was really exciting because it was Senate Republicans who, along with Senate Democrats, who made that decision and who listened when people of faith came together and pointed out all the flaws in this guy, which shows that change is always possible, no matter what you think of the current political landscape. Speaking out always makes a difference. Mm. We've had more victories since then. I could talk about more recent ones, but those were the ones that gave me hope and helped me fuel. Even if they're not the biggest or the most headline-grabbing, they were the ones that speak to the circumstances and that you can always make a difference, even when you're looking at Trump's ICE or Senate Republicans or just how bad 2020 was. There was still hope even in that darkness.
How can folks get involved in your work, or is it as simple as signing up for the regular action alerts and taking it from there?
It's that simple. Go to faithfulamerica.org. There is a box where you can just put in your email or your zip code. Don't even need your name right away. You can also sign one of the petitions you see there on the homepage, and that will add you to the email list. We'd also love for you to follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And once you sign a petition, you may not see this on the website, but there are follow-up actions we'll sometimes send, and information, call alerts, additional updates that come after you sign a petition.
The Reverend Nathan Imsall is a priest in the Episcopal Church and executive director of Faithful America, online at faithfulamerica.org. Nathan, it is always good to talk with you. I'm so impressed by what you're doing. Keep making good trouble. And we'll talk again soon on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Good trouble. Love it. God bless. Take care.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift as we celebrate 15 years of continuous broadcasting. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See, Welton.